Welcome to the Michael Rivera What Really Happened radio show.
And aloha, America. Welcome to the show. It's Saturday morning here, end of the week. We're looking back. What an historic week it has been, obviously, with the election of Barack Obama to the presidency. And I was listening to the previous show, I don't often agree with that particular host, but he was absolutely correct. This silliness about whether Barack Obama is really black or only half black, I think it's pettiness by those few people for whom race really was an issue. I remember during the campaign, people were always writing in and saying, well, how can you support a black candidate? And my automatic reply to that was, Obama's black? You know, and because if you're listening to the man's words and his thought processes, it's very easy to forget his race. Okay, it's part of the background. I mean, we had Berlusconi just calling him tanned. You know, it shouldn't be an issue. And by this election, it wasn't an issue. And so this argument over whether he's really black or only half black or anything, I mean, that is right out of the days of the slave trade and at what percentage black parentage somebody could be grabbed and sold for money versus having to be allowed to be a truly white citizen of this country. And it's silly. And it's anachronistic, and it's very much out of place in this day and age. But, you know, for the black community to want to take pride in him as the nation's first black president, yeah, why not? They have a right to be proud. And, of course, with a black president now, we can move past this whole question of whether there is racial discrimination in this country any longer. And that means that those people who attempt to exploit racial divisions for personal profit, aggrandizement, and empowerment, well, they're going to have to find some other cause. Maybe they can go over and hang out with the global warming people up there in North Dakota. Now, looking back at this week, obviously, it was a very rough week for the Dow, and as predicted, the Dow was propped up for Monday and Tuesday for the benefit of the GOP during the election, and then once the election was over, the Dow plunged about as rapidly as McCain's chances for the White House, and it was down 500 points on Wednesday, a little less than 500 on Thursday. We had a little bit of a dead cat bounce at the very last second, about a half an hour before the closing bell on Friday, that brought it up about 250 points. But, you know, again, the long-term prognosis, it's going to continue down. The unemployment numbers are just shocking in the nation. And we're looking at 10 million people, you know, are just scrambling, trying to find work right now. And it's just really, really tough out there. We lost 250,000 jobs just in October. We lost almost 300,000 jobs just in September. And I think that Barack Obama is correct on one thing. Getting the economy back on track, getting jobs created, you know, is definitely the number one priority. And all this other stuff has to take second track. Now, looking at Obama's victory, people are still debating about it. It's very divisive. There's a lot of sore losers and whiners out there is the bottom line. And I remember back when in the 2004 election, when Kerry lost and there were accusations of vote fraud, which subsequently were proven, I might add. And Bush's defenders were all like Pills Limbaugh and Michael Savage were saying, "Ah, you're just sore losers and you're just whiners and you're just complaining because you can't accept the will of the people." Well, okay, here we have an election with an overwhelming margin of victory, the largest in U.S. electoral history. And now it's the hardline GOP people who are complaining and screaming and whining and acting like sore losers. Okay? You know, in this case, the margin of victory in this election was so great, vote fraud really wasn't a factor. There was vote fraud as they go into a closer examination of the Minnesota election. Because Al Franken and Norm Coleman are so close. It's one of three Senate races that are still unresolved at this point. And they're beginning to discover there were serious vote undercount problems. And, not surprisingly, they were in the districts where Obama was expected to do very well. So once again, we're seeing signs of vote fraud. But it wasn't enough. Vote fraud can shift a few percentage points. It can't reverse a landslide. On Tuesday, that's what happened. We had a landslide. Now, the landslide really wasn't about Barack Obama, personally, okay? What the landslide Tuesday was the rejection by the American people of the policies and practices of the last 8 years of the Bush/neocon administration. Remember that DVD obsession that it was being sent to voters in all the swing states? It was in newspapers, it was in magazines. Somebody spent probably about $25 million putting this hate mongering together, and then handing out free copies everywhere. And was inserted in newspapers, magazines. It was, I mean, if somebody had made a DVD that attacked Christianity or Judaism with the same tactics that this DVD attacked Islam, they would be up on hate crimes charges in every state of the union that they distributed this disc in. But the good news is, very obviously, despite the millions of dollars poured into this project and the handing of these things out, it didn't work. It didn't work. The American people see through these kind of stunts now. If there is a reason for the GOP trouncing that we saw this week, it is not Sarah Palin, although she bears part of the blame. It is that McCain was running a 20th century style political campaign at the dawn of the 21st century, and it didn't work because the American people are smarter, they are more perceptive, they are better educated to the methods and tactics of people like Karl Rove, and this humiliation this last week was the proof of that. So that DVD obsession, it didn't work. We'll probably, it's going to be a long time before we see somebody try a tactic like that again, because that one backfired. Then, of course, you had McCain screaming about redistribution of wealth, and he was trying to make a big issue about it. But that backfired as well, because Americans had already had a dose of redistribution of wealth with the bailout bill. Only the money was flowing from the working class, from whom wealth is generated in any economy, to the big Wall Street firms who got their rescue rammed through Congress in the space of a week and then promptly used the money to pay themselves bonuses. And so America is ready, whether you approve of it or not, America is ready for wealth to be redistributed back the other direction. And so McCain's screaming about Marxism and redistribution of wealth fell on very unsympathetic ears. The defeat of the GOP on Tuesday was a repudiation of the growing Christian theocratic movement in the United States, the faith-based initiative, the very overt support for the ascendancy of Christianity at the expense of all other religions. That was soundly repudiated by the voters on Tuesday. It was a repudiation of rule by fear. After 8 years of being told that, you know, anything less than total slavish devotion to the Bush administration was going to mean Osama bin Laden would leap out of our bedroom closet and redecorate our rooms while we slept, didn't work anymore. And Tuesday's trashing of the GOP was a repudiation of government by lies. We know the government lied to us about Iraq. We know the government lied to us about 9/11. We know the government of the last 8 years has lied to us about just about everything. In fact, it's probably easier to keep a list of those few times when they told us the truth. So Tuesday's vote was a repudiation of government by lie. We demand a government be truthful, or we're going to go with no government at all. We're going to take a break here. If you want to join us on the air, 800-259-9231, 800-259-9231. We got 2 hours to fill up today. We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Call Mike now at 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show. And if you were listening over the break there about another untold story, I was on my college archery team. Got a little varsity letter in archery. And so I know the story, but I'm not going to tell you. You're going to have to go to the website to find out. It is interesting, though. It is an interesting piece of history. All right. Now, getting back to the election this last week and the campaign and everything, the whiners and sore losers are screaming about Obama is going to be worse than Bush. And from the point of view of the very rich and the defense contractors and prison manufacturer and, you know, whoever makes the buckets that they use in waterboarding, yes, that's going to be true. Anytime there's a change of regime, there's a change of where the government's money is flowing and a change to the rules by which money flows through the economy to some people, away from other people. All politics, all political promises, when you strip out all the fancy schmancies, it's a promise to tax money away from these people over here and give it to the supporters and cronies over there. So, everyone who benefited under the Bush regime can realistically expect that the perks and bennies are now going to flow to someone else. Halliburton will not be getting the big fancy contracts, no big contracts that they were getting. Okay, the tax laws are going to change so that the tax breaks for the wealthy are going to be repealed, and tax breaks for middle class and workers are going to be added, or at least so far that's the plan. So, of course, the people who were getting rich under the Bush regime are seeing Obama as worse, and they're reacting that way. They're going to cry and scream and kick and throw tantrums. I mean, these are people whose sole measure of their self-worth is how big a pile of cash they can pile up in the living room and roll around on and feel good about themselves. So any threat to their wealth is perceived as a personal attack on them. And they're going to react that way. Any removal of wealth from these extraordinarily wealthy people, they perceive as a personal attack on them. And they're going to react that way. And they are reacting that way. We're seeing it all over the net right now. Now, one of the big issues about this, the new government and the new policies going in, the Democrats now control Congress. To a very large extent, they've got a Democratic president. And one of the things they want to put back in is the Fairness Doctrine. And this one is already creating quite a bit of controversy. And I'm going to start this segment by reading an email from a listener. One of your Republican callers last night commented on the Fairness in Media Doctrine. He seemed to disagree with the proposed resurrection of it. There was nothing in this law that censored anything, but merely provided for opposing views. I believe that is a good thing. In my area, the neoconservatives control the airwaves. There is no liberal or middle-of-the-road radio here. These stations carry all of the extreme right-wing shows like Limbaugh and Savage. If you try to call in with an opposing view, you get cut off instantly. One wealthy foreigner has bought up a big share of our media and has used this to divide the American people. It was a little funny to hear the caller say he did not think that fairness was fair. I believe he is wrong. By the way, Air America is alive and well. I listen to it every day and love it. That was another thing the caller was wrong about. Yeah, the caller was there definitely pushing an agenda. The Fairness Doctrine came into being back at a time before the alternative media really got going, before the Internet even, when most of the propagandization of the American people had to go through the corporate media, ABC, CBS, NBC, the newly minted Fox News, which I'll get to in just a minute. And that media was seen as predominantly liberal. And so the GOP forced through the Fairness Doctrine. And all the Fairness Doctrine says is that if a TV station or network or newspaper or magazine takes an editorial position on a political issue, that they are required by law to provide an equal amount of time or an equal amount of space to a representative of the opposing point of view. If a media outlet, TV network, newspaper, magazine, accepts paid advertisements from a political group, they are required by law to accept an equivalent amount of advertising from the opposing point of view. That is the fairness doctrine. Now, obviously, when the media was perceived as having a liberal bias, this was a good thing for the Republicans. And but once they got into power, they started using their money to basically buy up the media. Fox News was created right from the start with a very strongly conservative bias. Clear Channel Corporation was created, you know, almost coincidental with the presidency of George W. Bush. Vast sums of money came in, started buying up all small market radio stations. Congress passed laws basically rescinding the restrictions on how much media any one company could own in one market. Those laws had existed to preserve a diversity of opinion. Those laws were rescinded, and all of a sudden you have these mega corporations like Clear Channel buying up everything in sight. And then they put on Rush Limbaugh and Michael Savage and basically owned it all. And coincident with that, with the rise of GOP conservative dominance in the media, the fairness doctrine was rescinded. So now these new media companies that had a conservative bias were no longer required to give equal airtime, equal exposure to the opposing point of view. Well, now the Democrats are back in charge, and they want to bring back the fairness doctrine. And so the GOP, which thought this was such a wonderful idea back when they thought the media had a liberal bias, now they're opposed to it because now the media is biased towards the conservative. And they like that just fine. And so we're seeing all these screaming hype claims about this is censorship and they're going to come in and make the websites, they're going to tell the websites what to post and so forth and so on. And first of all, I don't think they can because even with a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president, we still have a very conservative Supreme Court, which takes the First Amendment very, very, very seriously. And that isn't what's in the Fairness Doctrine anyway. But where I think they're going to fail on this is they're still fighting the campaign by the methods that lost them the election. They're exaggerating the danger of the opposing point of view. They're making making claims about the Fairness Doctrine, which anybody who checks into it are going to realize it's just more of the same kind of lies that we've been getting all along. So, of course, people are going to turn off. They're not going to be sympathetic to this idea that we shouldn't bring back the Fairness Doctrine. But I'll tell you the real issue of what's going on here, and the reason the GOP is so terrified of the Fairness Doctrine, because even though conservative interests still own a lion's share of the media, if the Fairness Doctrine comes back in, then everybody who's got information on the GOP crimes and the Bush crimes of the last 8 years are going to be demanding equal time on the air. When Fox News comes out with a special that claims that 9/11 happened exactly the way the Bush government said it did, you're going to have people demanding equal time. I'll be one of them. To say, we want fair time to present the evidence that we were lied to about 9/11. And that is what has the GOP absolutely terrified of the Fairness Doctrine. We're going to be back with phone calls we've got waiting on the line after these words from our sponsor. If you want to join us, 800-259-9231. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
He's scared, he's lonely, and he knows he screws up everything in life. But I guess that's the way it goes when you're the Antichrist. He's aroused by all things evil. That's why he wants more war. When he gets to the other side, maybe he'll wonder what it's all been for. He's George W. Bush.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. The caller we had waiting on the line just dropped, which I think shows very poor taste on his part. Now, getting back to Barack Obama here, and a lot of the screeching that is going on in the wake of his decisive victory on Tuesday. A lot of people are, of course, pointing to the issue of gun rights, gun stores across America are reporting a surge of business from people who are concerned that if they don't buy certain weapons now, that it may become much more difficult to after the first of the year. And yes, that's obviously going to become an issue. Obviously, I disagree with Barack Obama on the issue of gun rights, but the reality is, and we all have to learn to live with this, the only time you're ever going to get a politician you agree with 100% is to run for office yourself. Now, like the fairness doctrine, Obama's opponents have abused facts on the gun issue. Obama is not planning to confiscate all the guns in America. He has stated that he understands and respects the Second Amendment and the reasons behind it. Now, Obama and indeed the Democratic Party as a whole, the liberal agenda, they have an issue with certain types of weapons, high-capacity magazines, assault weapons, guns that they see as not really germane to target shooting or hunting or even home security. Now, of course, I obviously disagree with the liberal point of view that the Second Amendment is about hunting and about target shooting. It isn't. It says right in the amendment that the security of a free state, and they talk about a citizen's militia. So obviously the Second Amendment is about allowing the American people to have military-style weapons in their possession to hold off abusive government. This, of course, was the big mistake the British made that led to the battles of Lexington and Concord. And as a historical side note, during the French and Indian Wars, when William Henry fell from the British to the French, the French forces allowed the citizens' militia to leave the fort with their weapons because they understood fully well that if they didn't have their guns, they weren't going to eat and they were not going to survive the winter. And so it was understood that, having weapons was not the issue. It was the use you were going to put them to. And, the liberals like to blame the guns for the gun crime and don't understand that if you take away the guns, criminals are going to find something else to use. Take a look at places like Great Britain that have banned guns completely and crime goes up. It's just carried out with knives. And Japan, they're very big on knives and swords and blades over there. So, this is an issue that Barack and I are going to be clashing about in the years to come here. But you need to understand, when you get back to this issue of military weapons to hold a government at bay, Barack Obama is a member of the government, and you cannot expect him to be sympathetic to the need to arm ourselves in advance of a potential revolution against a corrupt government, especially because the coming economic crash is going to create the perfect climate for a revolution to occur. And we already know, at least during the Bush administration, our government has been making serious plans on how to deal with a very angry and upset American people. And, we're already on the edge from 8 years of Bush. And, there's a lot of cheering about Barack Obama's ascendancy to the Oval Office, but I don't think that's going to erase the abuses of the last 8 years from the minds of the American people. They're already on a hair trigger. A significant economic crash and massive unemployment, I think, will push them right over the edge. If Obama needs to deal with that, if he needs to provide a target for the anger of the American people in order to forestall a revolution, I recommend war crimes trials for the current administration. And just put them up there and just say, these are the people who did it. And the American people will say, yes, they're the people who did it. Tar and feather them and kick them out. And that might be the only device to hold off an outright revolution, is to deal honestly and forthrightly with 9/11 and the war in Iraq and the torture situation and punish the guilty. And if the American people see the guilty being punished, then maybe they'll hold off punishing the entire government. Just something to keep in mind as the situation continues to deteriorate in the economy. Now, the reality, however, is that Obama has higher priorities right now in the economy and in the wars. It's not like Obama's going to go into the Oval Office on day one and just magically reshape the entire government. These things take time, And government is choosing. Government is prioritizing. And right now, the issue of guns, absent some staged event by organized crime, which wants us all disarmed so that their minions can loot us at will, absent some staged, horrendous, newsworthy incident, I think the gun issue has to be low down on Barack Obama's list of things he's got to do, because the first thing he's got to do is jobs, okay? And he's got to make things look better for the economy. Obama won his office on the premise that he is not Bush. He's talking about change. So any kind of databasing, data mining, record-keeping, registration is going to be reminiscent of what we were going through for the last 8 years, and it's going to just absolutely savage his approval rating and his political support among the general population. I don't think he wants to do that, because he already knows he's facing some very unpopular, unpleasant choices and decisions he's got to make. And, you know, your politicians look at their approval rating and their popularity and their support. It's not just vanity. They realize that if they have approval numbers, you know, this is the coin of the realm in Washington, D.C., where they can go out and they can spend some of that approval numbers to push certain agendas. If the approval numbers go down, then they have to be a little bit more careful picking and choosing what they're going to go with. That's how the game gets played. The higher Barack Obama's approval numbers, the longer his coattails are, and the more congressmen will hop on for the ride as he moves forward. But already, Obama is spending his support coin, his popularity coin, with choices like Rahm Emanuel as his chief of staff. This has not been well received in a lot of places. So, you know, I think the gun issue, we're not going to see much happening on that, at least for the first year of the administration, at least until the economy turns around. And that really is the highest priority. So Obama needs to create... I'm sorry, we're going to stop here because this is a natural stopping point. We have Thomas on the phone from Sweden. Aloha, Thomas. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Mr. Rivero and listeners. Aloha to everybody.
And what's on your mind?
Okay, you brought up two constitutional points already here while I was listening. I actually called in about the media fairness law.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that you're for it, and you're in very good company, namely James Madison's. In his notes from the Constitutional Convention, he meant press freedom to be more than we think it is today. It's not only that the newspapers and the radios and the televisions get to say what they think. It meant also, in his opinion, access by the public to the media in order to express, let's say, a divergent opinion in the letters to the editor's column.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, you're in very good company.
Well, I consider myself very much a traditionalist and a constitutionalist, and yes, that's absolutely true. And, wow, lousy timing here. Thomas, can you stick with us through the commercial break?
I will face the music with you for anything.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Thomas. Stay with us. We're going to be back after these words from our sponsors.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNLive.com today.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Call Mike now at 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231.
And aloha, America. Welcome back. This is the last segment of hour one of our Saturday show. We have Thomas on the line from Sweden. We're talking about the fairness doctrine, its roots in the original founding fathers. And, you know, people need to remember that all of the Bill of Rights, the protections about freedom of speech and freedom of association and freedom of assembly, were all written specifically to deal with politics. The First Amendment protection of free speech was designed to protect freedom of political speech. Really doesn't have anything to do with the content of art or sculpture or statues or even exotic dancers. That's not what it was intended for. It was intended to preserve the right of ordinary citizens to speak out on matters of political importance to the land, because they had just broken free from King George III, who absolutely discouraged, you know, any dissent against his policies. So, yeah, Madison was absolutely right. The whole point of the Fairness Doctrine and freedom of the press wasn't to give the freedom to people who own the printing press, but to give people freedom of access to the press. And, yes, that's the reason newspapers have letters to the editor columns to this very day, to basically conform with that requirement. But ultimately, I think that it was not until the age of the Internet and the blogosphere that we achieved Madison's ideal.
Great. Can we go to Article 2, then, of the Articles, in addition to an amendment of the Constitution of the United States? I have something on that.
By all means.
Okay. Now, people say, oh, well, if you're going to go hunting, I don't know, mutant hamsters, for example, you don't need an assault rifle. Article 2.
Well, you do in our case.
I'm not going near your studio. Article 2 has nothing to do with hunting. Article 2 has to do with protecting yourself from the government. So if you need an assault rifle, you have a right to have one.
That's absolutely correct. The Second Amendment talks about the security of a free state. It's not talking about food. It's not talking about the Olympic shooting team. It talks about security, and therefore the implied meaning of the Second Amendment is that the American people have a right to keep and bear military arms. And that is absolutely the interpretation I support. And the reality is, the kinds of guns that the gun grabbers in government are going after, the military-style weapons, aren't really used all that often in the commission of crimes. Yes, the drug lords will do drive-by shootings with Uzis and AKs, but 99% of gun crime is done with these little cheap Saturday night specials, which are lousy firearms to begin with, and I can't imagine a serious shooter wanting to own one. But the government's real concern isn't the reduction of crime, because the presence of crime in our society justifies the police presence and control and passage of more laws on us. But what the government wants to do is to make sure that the American people are kept in a weakened and therefore subordinate state to the will of the government. And that's kind of where the conflict comes from. But you're absolutely correct in my opinion. The Second Amendment is not about hunting and target shooting. It's about the American people having weapons of serious enough firepower to hold off a tyrannical government.
Okay, I guess I have about another 24 or 5 amendments left. I'll take those another time, all right? And I wish you and the listeners and the people who are paid to listen to this program a very nice weekend.
Well, whatever they're being paid, it is not enough. I know that for a fact. All right.
Okay,
thanks a lot for the call, Thomas. And please call back in again, because I really appreciate it when you come on the air from all the way over there in Sweden. My goodness. Send me a picture postcard sometime.
Will do.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. Now, as I was saying before, and we're coming up to the end of the hour, and we'll take it into hour two when more of our ground affiliates join us, and they'll turn on the show saying, what the heck are they talking about? We're coming in right in the middle here. Obama's number one priority is going to be job creation, and I do not mean creating pointless make-work jobs that are just an excuse to hand people a government check and not call it welfare. I'm opposed to make-work projects like gratuitous regulation and paperwork shuffling. The Transportation Safety Administration, is a make-jobs program. Doesn't really do any good, doesn't really make us any safer from terrorists. Probably a lot of you have seen the video, it's out on YouTube, of a TSA guy just asleep at the X-ray machine at an airport. I mean, they're there, they get their little peep show X-ray machines to see us all naked. They get to fondle cute young girls or cute young guys, depending upon which way they swing. They get to confiscate our media players to make sure we're not carrying pirated copies of the latest top 10 hits. They get to drop and break laptops with impunity. You know, these make-work projects, these gratuitous, let's just create a need and fill it with a bunch of people just so that they can say they've got meaningful jobs. It's a temporary bandage on the real problem. And the real problem is, as a nation, we do not produce much of anything that anybody else in the world wants to buy. We're hearing about the problems with General Motors and Ford, and they're not selling cars, and they're not able to make it happen, and they're asking for government bailouts, and they're letting workers go, and they're shutting factories. Well, that's the real problem there is nobody around the world wants to buy their product. Yes, American sales are down because we're in a dark economy, but there is the export market. But they can't compete in the export market because they don't make a competitive product. And I hate to be this way because I have tried to buy American so many times in my life, and every time I get disappointed. When I get an American product, it fails to perform. And then I go out and get the Japanese equivalent or the German equivalent. And it's well made and well designed, and it just works wonderfully. This headset that I do the show on is from Germany, and it's just amazingly well made. And so that's really the heart of our problem. So what Obama has to do, he can't just start handing out checks, and he can't just start saying, okay, we're going to create, you know, a new department of putting things on top of other things and pay a bunch of people to just put stickers on stuff. We have enough paid professional putter sticker honors in our society as it is. Obama needs to create a climate that encourages innovation, the development of new technologies, entrepreneurialism, which is a part of our economy that Bush definitely turned his back on, which will in turn create new technologies, which will create new industries, which will create meaningful jobs that make products that we sell to other countries to bring money back into this country. That is Obama's top number one task, to revitalize our technological base, to bring back America's technological leadership so that we can be again at the forefront of new product creation, new technology, new methods, new processes, whatever. We need to regain that lead that we used to have. One of the reasons I support the space program so strongly is not because I want to see America's flag on the moon or Mars or Jupiter or Titan. It's because, aside from war, the space program has been the only time in our nation's history where we have this huge technological flowering. All these new ideas, these new methods. I would say probably wherever you're sitting, there's a bunch of stuff around you that was built on the technology that was developed during the race for the moon back in the 1960s. Solid state circuitry, integrated circuitry. You know, the watch on your hand, the calculator, the computer that runs your car now. All of that stuff was a direct outgrowth of technologies developed in the race for the moon. That's the real value of the investment in the space program. Not that we get some rocks from a faraway place or we find out that Mars once had water. Those are interesting things. But the real payback for investment in the space program is the new technologies on which we build these new industries, new products, and new jobs. And that really is why I am hoping that Barack Obama will renew our commitment to the space program. And, I would be the first to agree. Being a member of the old NASA and having seen the new NASA come in, there are a lot of problems with the way it's being managed right now. But I think we need to have a program that stimulates new technology. We'll cover this on the other side of the news. We're going to stop for commercials and news. We'll be back with hour two after this break. So stay tuned and aloha. And aloha, America. Welcome back to hour two of our show today. And for those of you just joining us for hour two, the subject under discussion that we held over from the first hour is the necessity of Barack Obama not to just create pointless jobs to hand out paychecks, but to build a climate in which innovation, entrepreneurialism can take root to create new technologies on which to base new industries and new products, to create new jobs, and to basically improve our exporting situation. Because right now, the reason the United States economy is in such terrible shape that it's in, We don't make anything the rest of the world wants to buy. Our automakers are struggling to survive. And, yes, American sales are down because our economy is in severe difficulty. But there's the export market out there. And we have certainly Germany and Japan and a lot of other places exporting cars into the United States. If we were making a competitive product at Ford and GM, we should be sending American cars out to other countries where they would be bought. But we don't make a competitive product. We're lagging behind in a lot of these areas of manufacturing and technology. So as we ended hour one, we were talking about the space program and why I support it, not because I want to see America's flag planted on the moons of Jupiter, but because I recognize, having been there in the 1960s and 70s and having been part of NASA back during the old NASA days, the technological fallout of everything that had to be developed in order to take men to the moon and bring them back, those were the source of so much that we have in our lives today, the microprocessors in your computer and your watch and in your car. And I had a reader email come in over the break saying, don't forget telecommunications. Partly, yes. The Internet, we can't say that NASA had anything to do with that. That was actually developed as a communications means originally for the military under the Advanced Research Projects Agency. But it broke free and became public and became the Internet, for which we're grateful. But NASA has been the source of a lot of technology that resulted in a techno boom, if you will, throughout the 60s and 70s and the 80s. Well, we've fallen off that pedestal. We need to get back on. And the problem with developing technology to support war is the government will always hold that away from the public for 10 to 20 years. And what we need are new industries and new technologies now. And the only place you get that kind of brainstorming and idea generation is through the space program. So we definitely, that's one possible area I hope Obama will be paying close attention to, because we need to make jobs that create products that bring money back into the country. If we just do make work, like, you know, we create a whole bunch of need for new regulation and form filling out in order to force companies to hire form filler outers and sticker putter honors, that doesn't really solve the problem. It's at best a temporary band. If we're going to go to the phones, we've got John in Illinois. Aloha, John. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Hi, Mike. Long time no talk to you. It's good hearing you again. Of course, I'm from Illinois, Obama's home state, and living right
now. Wait a minute. I'm in Hawaii. This is Obama's home state.
I'll believe that.
Cream puffs at 20 paces right now.
Yeah, I'll believe that when they produce the vault copy, Mike.
Yeah. Lingle will get it for you.
I just wanted to, this might be a little bit off topic, but it does have to do with Obama. Remember Herb Block, the old cartoonist?
Yes.
I'm going to extend to Obama the same courtesy that Herb Block extended to Richard Nixon when he was elected. He gave him the benefit of the doubt, and he said so in one of his editorial cartoons. I hope that Obama does well. But there's a little bit of hypocrisy that I have personal experience with Obama.
Mm-hmm.
I sent him a copy of Jerome Corsi's book, The Late Great USA. And Mr. Obama returned the book to me in saying he cannot accept gifts of books from anyone other than the author, and yet he takes $700,000 from Goldman Sachs, $2.1 million from the banking lobbying interests, and God knows how many other millions of dollars from special interest groups. Doesn't that strike you as a little ironic?
No, it doesn't, because the issue of the book issue, there's actually a litigation exposure there. And believe it or not, we have the same thing that we deal with in the film industry, where if somebody other than the book's author sends us the book and we somehow use a quote, then the author is in a position to sue. So I understand why Barack Obama does that. As far as the money that he got from all these different groups, you know, when it became obvious he was going to win, everybody piled on and gave him money because they all want to buy favors with the incoming administration. And these same people, Goldman Sachs, they also gave money to McCain. They're buying both sides of the election, so it doesn't matter who wins. And that is, unfortunately, an aspect of our current way that we have of financing campaigns. You know, somewhere down the road we may be able to change it. But right now, If you go back and you look at the demographic breakdown of Barack Obama's donors at the beginning of his campaign, most of his support was coming from the grassroots. It wasn't until it became obvious he was going to win, like trouncing Hillary. That's when all the big players said, okay, we gotta give him money so that we're gonna be owed favors when he gets into office because we don't want to be left out totally in the cold. And, you know, that's it. The more you look like you're going to win, the more people will give you money. They may not even like you, but they're going to give you the money because they want to be able to say, I donated $700 million to your campaign, and therefore you owe me blah, 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 blah. And all professional politicians know that if you don't repay the favors you are given, you don't get any more favors.
I agree, Mike. They get fed from both sides. I understand that, but I thought it was a little ironic about not accepting a book. I can understand the movie maker's position of not accepting the book because of copyright violations or whatever, but a book expressing ideas on how to run the affairs of our government, how to conduct policy, that just really all the other my other senator and my representative, they graciously accepted the book. They didn't return it to me.
Well, it's just a matter of personal policy, and as I said, there is a litigation issue there. And of course, don't forget Jerome Corsi is the guy who's been leading the charge on this claim that Barack Obama was not a citizen or not eligible to be the president. So I can understand why Obama's office might just not really be all that interested in the book to begin with. So, I don't think one really has anything to do with the other.
Okay. All right. Good enough, Mike. We'll take it at that. We'll call it a draw.
We'll call it a draw.
Bye-bye.
But Obama is from here in Hawaii, so there. Thanks for the call, John. Okay. Yeah. Now that he's won, we're all going to say, no, he was here. This is his home state. He belongs to us, and all the rest of his thing. God, it's funny seeing how this thing works. All right. I'm going to move on here to another topic, and... yeah, this is sort of, kind of, maybe, in a way, linked to Obama's high priority to create meaningful new jobs. Not just make work, but we need to have new jobs in new industries making products that we can sell. Because all the political speechification aside, the hard, cold reality is if we don't have a product to sell, we will not get the economy back on track. I know that Wall Street lives on this illusion that if they just take the money and shake it back and forth hard enough, that it will just magically grow all by itself. And as long as they have a Federal Reserve willing to print up new paper notes or tally more numbers in the computers to make it look like the money is growing, it'll all seem like it's hunky-dory. But if you're talking about bringing real wealth back into the country, we've got to be making something somebody wants to buy. The last 8 years were all... operated on the basis that we could go and invade our way to wealth, that we could go conquer the Mideast oil and use it to reverse the balance of trade across our borders, that we could use oil to recollateralize the American dollar, that we could use the threat of control of the oil to get foreign nations to whom we owe all this money to back off and renegotiate the loans and possibly even write some of them off. Well, that policy failed. That policy absolutely failed. So now we got to get back to the reality that if you're going to prosper a nation, that nation has to have products for sale to other nations that those nations want to buy, that provide good quality at a good price. It's a basic rule of commerce, and I don't understand why our government has had such trouble understanding that. We're going to take a break here. We'll be right back. If you want to join us on the air, 800-259-9231, 800-259-9231. We'll be right back.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Well, search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Fear and hate will rule them, said the demon to his throne. In shackles we will bind them, to the terror they'll be shown. As mindless slaves they will not think, blind eyes they will not see. They'll jail themselves and call the bars Homeland Security.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. And the subject under discussion is what I view as Barack Obama's priorities to get this nation back on track, to get the economy back on track. And we were talking about the creation of new technologies and new industries that are competitive in the world marketplace. And a big key to rebuilding America's economy is we have got to reform our educational system. And we've got to change it back from just being this political indoctrination center that just warehouses kids while both parents are forced to work. And we need to restore it to a teaching institution where kids learn the basic skills, the science, the math, the physics needed to build products and companies that compete in the modern world. And by science, I do not mean the debate over the Bible versus Darwin. That is more political, religious indoctrination. If you want to be religiously indoctrinated, go to church. But the public school system needs to be educating our young people to be able to assume roles within our society that function in the real world. And by that, I mean, you know, chemistry, physics, electronics, engineering, how to design and build new machines. We've got to stop terrorizing our kids into wanting to be soldiers and teach them to be technological citizens of the world. Right now, the United States of America, the nation that put men on the moon, ranks 33 in the world for scientific literacy. We just barely beat Turkey. So I want you to think about that. 1960s, the United States put men on the moon. 2008, we're just barely beating Turkey in scientific literacy in our culture. That is really a measure of the decline of our nation's schools and the education of our young people. And I know there are a few bright spots here and there in the country, but overall, the educational level of our children, it's just not there. It's not there. They're being taught, they're being propagandized to support this and that agenda. They're teaching global warming mythology and claiming that's science. And as they freeze up in North Dakota, it's obvious we're not going to see a tremendous boom to our economy out of that particular area. We're going to go to the phones. We've got Mike in Maryland. Aloha, Mike. What's on your mind?
Hey, aloha. Thanks for taking my call. One day I want to go back to Hawaii and visit it. I don't know. I can't afford it right now. But at any rate, though, I'm going to talk about the economy. And, I'm not an expert by any stretch of the imagination, but somebody put it in succinct terms of creating wealth. He says there's three basic ways, and maybe this is too simplistic, I don't know. But he said there's three basic ways to create wealth, either through agriculture or mineral extraction or through manufacture, you know, and everything else is just, you know, shuffling paper around.
He's absolutely correct.
And through the our government paying farmers not to grow food, and thus we're importing now 50% of our food, and through, you know, Rush Limbaugh calls them environmental wackos, and some environmental laws are good and some of them I think are bad, but because of that, a lot of the mineral wealth that we used to extract has been cut down and stopped, and also because of, I think there's a program called Overseas Private Investment Corporation, another program that rewards companies for moving overseas. We've lost much of our, and there's a myriad of reasons why we're losing our manufacturing wealth. Some people want to blame the union. Some people blame the corporations. Some people want to blame the lazy American workers or the environmental laws. There's a myriad of reasons, but basically, you know, it's too easy for corporations to move overseas. And so the bottom line is, this isn't by accident. And everything Congress does, and no matter who we have for president, you may or may not know, I'm not enthused with Obama, but I'm not enthused with McCain either. But no matter who gets elected president, everything our government does is only going to make things worse. Because having another stimulus package is going to put us deeper in debt.
Correct.
The things that our government and Congress needs to do, they won't do, or they can't do. Because the powers that be, the pressure on them, to put tariffs back on goods, to bring their manufacturing back, you know, the pressure, the financial pressure against them to do that is so great that they won't do it. So the bottom line is they're creating a third world police state.
Yes, they absolutely are. They absolutely are. And the problem is, and this goes all the way back to Abraham Lincoln, as you said, the corporations, once they were given legal personhood, they effectively became societal gods because they're immortal. They never die unless they commit suicide through stupid mistakes. And they accumulate wealth, you know, in multi-generational, time spans that us mere mortals cannot compete with. And they use that money to reshape the world to suit their own immediate needs. And if you go back and you look over the last 8 years, and I know there's a lot of people like Alex Jones who wants to see some grand plot behind all of it, but really just personal greed, short-sightedness, accident, and stupidity really explains a lot of what we've seen over the last 8 years. This moving of jobs to other countries, while the labor's cheaper there, the countries are taxed lower, it costs less to live there, so yeah, your labor costs are going to go down. And, you know, it's all very good for the first few companies who do it, but then when everybody starts doing it and the American worker doesn't have, you know, an option to be able to make the money to pay his credit card bills, they're going to stop buying things. And so it was a very short-sighted thing to do that looked good for the first few companies who did it, and they made money and they shared the wealth with their political candidates. But when enough people had done it, then we've got a real, real problem. And where we are right now, we have been losing our manufacturing going back about 30 years now. Because this all started back in the 19... I'm sorry?
About 30 or 40, somewhere in the neighborhood.
Yeah, somewhere in the neighborhood, we started letting these things go. And some of our big core manufacturing factories have been shut down and either dismantled and sold off or just simply allowed to corrode away to a mess. So we're not going to get our manufacturing turned back on overnight. And even if we do, even if we reopen these factories, we're playing catch up with those other countries that built newer factories and better factories, and they're already up to speed. So the key to regaining a place in the world market is that we have to develop new products where we're starting out on a par with all the other countries because they're not making the hydrostatic flammer stand and we're just starting out to make it and we've got the patents and we develop it and sell it, then we're taking the technological lead again. So we can't just say, let's bring back the old vacuum factory and restart it again, or the old shoe factory. We can't do that. It won't work. We have to invent the next generation of whatever people are going to want to buy, and we have to set up the system so it gets built here in the United States. Apple is a good example. They've got these wonderful, you know, the iPod, the iPhone, and they're wonderful toys. And it proves that with good management, products made in China, you know, can be really good. But why aren't they being made here in the United States? That's what I want to know. And that's what we have to get back to. Mike, thank you very much for the call. We got to take a break here for some commercials. And we'll be back talking about our nation and its current state and the challenge that Obama faces. And frankly, I don't envy him his job. We'll be right back.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Call Mike now at 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. We're talking about the state of the United States in the context of the challenges that are facing the new Barack administration. And I remember during the campaign joking about both McCain and Obama saying that really anybody who wanted the job at this particular time in our history, you had to view them with some suspicion as to whether they were really sane or not, and that this could very easily be the first presidency where the 25th Amendment was invoked on Inauguration Day. But all kidding aside, Americans love to believe that they're the best nation on earth, the greatest nation on earth, the most moral nation on earth, and our image has taken a real battering on some of those over the last 8 years. But let me give you some of the hard reality about life in the United States right now. The United States ranks 30th in life expectancy. This is a direct reflection on the decline in health care in the United States. We are rated number 17 in terms of democracy. There are 16 other nations that are far more democratic than we are. We rank 41st in terms of freedom of the press, and that would be of the corporate media. Obviously, the blogosphere and alternative media are not calculated into that yet. But the corporate media of the United States is ranked 41st in freedom of the press. We're below Taiwan and just above Macedonia. In terms of our internet speed, and we are the nation that invented the internet, and we rank 15th in the world in terms of the bandwidth of our internet here in the United States. In terms of prison population, and the idea being that the smallest prison population is the ideal. It means your society is functioning and well-balanced, and everybody's got a job, and everybody's happy, and nobody has to turn to crime to get by. And we rank 40th below Russia in terms of the number of people that we have incarcerated in our prisons. In terms of the absence of corruption, we rank 22nd. We're more corrupt than Chile is right now. The effectiveness of our education, I was talking about this before in the last segment, we rank 35th in the world. We're behind Russia in terms of the effectiveness of our education. In terms of renewable energy use, for all the talk that we hear from various political opportunists trying to exploit energy as a political issue, we rank 27th in the world. We're behind Australia in terms of the development of renewable energy. Scientific literacy, as I mentioned before talking about education, we rank 33rd in the world. Quality of our health care, we rank 37th in the world. It's the most expensive. American medical care is the most expensive in the world at the hands of the HMOs. Our quality of health care has declined to 37th. In terms of infant survival rate, the United States ranks 31. We're worse than Slovakia in terms of infant mortality. So this is the situation of the United States. We are not number one in pretty much anything anymore. We're way down the list. We are a nation very clearly in decline. And I think last Tuesday's absolute trashing of the Republicans had far less to do with Barack Obama. In fact, I think at this point, in hindsight, Daffy Duck could have beat John McCain. Not because anybody really cares that much about Daffy Duck. It was just, we know the path we've been on for the last 8 years is not working. And beyond that, we know the path that we've been on for the last 30 years is not working. Somewhere along the way, and this may go back to that whole MBA generation that started at the end of World War II, we stopped disrespecting the actual creation of wealth, whether it's agriculture. Our society tends to view farmers as very low in the social order. Extraction of mineral wealth, same thing. Miners and oil workers are considered very low in the social order of things. And the manufacturing of products, also viewed as socially inferior in our society. And yet, those are the three endeavors that bring wealth into the country, that create actual wealth. And somehow we created a management culture that thought the exact process by which wealth was being created was no longer important, because it's all scientific management. As long as I follow the same rules with the PERT charts and the Gantt charts and scientific management, that I can manage anything, whether I'm overseeing the manufacturing of rearview mirrors this week or pharmaceuticals the next week or TV sets the week after that. Not that we make any more TV sets in this country. And that created, as these MBAs moved upward in our corporate culture, it created a corporate culture that disrespected the actual generation of products and the generation of wealth. And they started judging their companies and corporations' value and success not on the sales and quality of the products that they were selling, but on the performance of the stocks. And that have inevitably led to gaming the stock market system. And Wall Street transformed from a means for ordinary Americans to invest in the productivity of the United States into a gigantic East Coast open-air casino where they were just playing with the values of the stock, and they were bump and dumping, and they were running the values up and down, and the plunge protection team was pushing the numbers up so that Clinton could use them as a political banner, and then later on Bush did exactly the same. And the stock market became almost completely disconnected from the productivity of the nation. And America fell in love with this idea that they could just wave the money back and forth hard enough and it would grow all by itself. And it doesn't work that way. The American corporate elite and our subservient political system wandered off into this fantasy land where money just magically appeared in the computers as long as you played the game by the correct rules. And they really forgot that wealth, real wealth, meaningful wealth, comes out of the ground, comes out of the ocean, grows out of the soil, or you've got somebody in a factory taking those raw materials and making something that somebody else wants to buy. That is how you prosper a nation. You make products that other nations want to buy. That's how it works. All right, we're almost to the end of this segment here, and just a real quick comment about Senator Joseph Lieberman, who, of course, became notorious for losing his Democratic primary, declaring himself as an independent, and then somehow magically rewinning his Senate seat as an independent, defeating the guy who defeated him in the Democratic primary. Can you say vote fraud? I knew you could. Well, because Lieberman supported McCain throughout the whole campaign season, my understanding is that Lieberman thought he was going to be the vice presidential nominee before Ms. Palin got the nod. Well, now Lieberman wants to return to status quo ante and say, all right, well, it's kiss and make up time. And the Democrats are saying, no, we don't think so. And Lieberman's trying to go back in and resume his various committee chairmanships in the new reconstituted Senate. And the Democrats, who don't really need him to be a Democrat anymore, are giving signals that they would prefer he stay an independent. And so now today we're getting a story that Lieberman is going over to the Republicans and saying, well, look, I supported your guy for president and rescued him from oblivion earlier in the year, and so maybe I want to be a Republican now. And apparently he's getting a very cold shoulder over there. And so, Joe, well, you know, you flip around like that, and people wonder just where your loyalties lie. And so he may have a very hard time finding a niche for himself in the new Congress. All right, we're going to take a break, come back for the last segment of today's show. If you want to join us on the air, 800-259-9231, 800-259-9231. We will be right back.
Can we talk?
Can we talk?
Can we talk about gun control?
Gun control?
Seems like it should work, doesn't it?
It should work.
You'd think so. Yeah.
Pass the right laws.
Pass the right laws.
Then you can disarm the criminals.
You disarm them.
That's the idea.
But the problem is...
The problem?
Criminals don't obey the law.
They don't obey the law.
That's true.
After all, they're criminals.
They're criminals.
Criminals. They'll always find a way to get guns.
No matter how many laws you pass.
Which means...
Which means... They still have guns.
They still have guns. While the rest of us...
The rest of us?
The rest of us are just left defenseless.
When all this twists and steel, what's swept away? Did these remaining holes reveal what?
Aloha, America. Welcome back. Final segment of today's show. And boy, you know, I used to worry about the show. I'd start out and I'd say, boy, do I have enough to talk about and everything. And these days it just seems like there's so much happening that there's stuff left over, which is fine because I'll just bleed it into Monday there. I did want to talk about briefly this. We've had these anthrax hoaxes happening across the country. There was one just yesterday in the Warner Brothers building in Burbank where packages are arriving in the mail or packages are being left by anonymous gifters that proclaim they contain anthrax. And so far, they've all been harmless, but they're upsetting people. They're putting people on edge. And if it were happening just a few places, I'd say, okay, it's just some sore losers from the McCain campaign trying to booga-booga us all one more time. But it seems to be happening quite a bit around the country. And it is putting people on edge, and people on edge are much easier to panic if and when the real thing shows up. We know that Bush has another 2 months with which he can basically do whatever he feels like. The election's over. The GOP got trashed. They're going to be a long time coming back from this defeat. And, you know, this is the time period where historically presidents just do whatever they feel like they want to do. And we know that Bush has been tightening the economic screws on Iran. We are continuing to see a ramp up on the rhetoric against Iran as a threat, even though the official U.S. government national intelligence estimate on Iran's intentions and nuclear capability, which is posted for all to see right now at whatreallyhappened.com, the official U.S. government national intelligence estimate says that Iran stopped building and developing nuclear weapons in 2003. So our government has known all along that Iran is not building nuclear weapons. Excuse me, Mr. Bush, nuclear weapons. They've known all along. It's just rhetoric to try and justify another invasion of another oil-bearing country that we could then garrison from now till the end of time in the hopes that somehow we can suck enough oil out of it to pay for all this mess, which is nonsense. Bush is spending 10 times as much in Iraq as it would have cost to simply buy the oil that they're trying to pump out of there. So the next 2 months, we may well see President Bush and the neocons and Israel try and create yet another war to stick Barack Obama with. And I've postulated for a long time that anthrax, because it's been given so much press by the press, that anthrax might be the device used in the false flag attack. And I mention that because anthrax is actually not a biological agent a real terrorist would use. Anthrax, weaponized anthrax, is a battlefield weapon. And the difference is anthrax spores will infect people who breathe those spores in. But those people who become sick with anthrax don't give it to other people. It has low secondary communicability. That is why it has been developed and weaponized as a battlefield weapon. Spray it on the enemy troops, they'll get sick. But they won't infect their doctors, nurses, or the civilians around them. You don't have the risk of a runaway contagion completely destroying the country you're trying to invade and conquer, which would just be a big drag on everybody. So that's why anthrax was developed. It is a weapon to be used by an invading force that has a lot of airplanes where they can spray the battlefield with it, make everybody sick, they get sick, stop fighting, the war's over, the disease is contained in that immediate vicinity. A real terrorist who does not have fleets of airplanes to seed wide areas of a battlefield is going to want to use a biological agent with high secondary communicability. So they go in and they spray an international airport at the departure gates, and all the people who breathe in this infectious agent, and they're still feeling fine, they get on the airplane, they immediately exhale this infectious agent, infecting everybody in the airplane, who are going to other airports, who will then infect other people, so forth and so on. The idea being that biowarfare for a terrorist means finding an infectious agent where your target population does the work of infecting the population for you. It spreads. They spread it around. They go to conventions. They go to hotels. They go to tourist resorts. and they spread the illness for the terrorists. And if the infectious agent has, for example, a 7 to 10 day incubation period before symptoms manifest, that's a lot of time for this thing to get going before it starts popping up. And so a real terrorist attack would not use anthrax. But anthrax is the perfect agent to use if you're faking a terrorist attack in order to declare martial law or scare the nation into agreeing to attack Iran or whoever the next designated target will be. So as we see these anthrax hoaxes across the country, and we hear talk about anthrax and Al-Qaeda is still out there and Iran is still a threat and all the rest of this that we're going to hear for the next 2 months, you know, just keep in mind that anthrax is not ideally suited for terrorism. It's a battlefield weapon. Real terrorists are going to use something that is going to hop from person to person to person to person to person. And anybody who can make anthrax can make the other things as well. It really is all over the place. Our government was selling it to Iraq. Who knows where it went from there? All right, moving right along then. Story is just breaking here. Apparently, during the Democratic National Convention, remember when we saw all the noise about protesters were causing a ruckus and everything? Well, it turns out those protesters were undercover police officers who were there to manufacture the illusion of a Democratic discord at the convention in order to make the Democrats look bad for the election. Obviously, that did not work. Apparently, not all of the Denver police were in on the hoax because the undercover cops playing protesters got pepper sprayed in the process. And apparently, it's because of that incident that this whole thing is coming to light. But again, it's another case of the government creating the situation that the media will then feed to you to trick you into agreeing with a given point of view. Now, speaking of the media, U.S. media company E.W. Scripps Company announced on Friday that it would cut 400 jobs as the weak advertising market inflicted another blow on the struggling U.S. newspaper industry. Okay, well, I have a message for Scripps and for all the other newspapers who are dealing with problems right now. It isn't the ads that are the problem. It is the lies. Now that Obama has won, a lot of the claims made about him during the campaign have been exposed as lies, along with, of course, all the lies of the last 8 years of the Bush administration that the media gladly, cheerfully promulgated out into the population. Iraq's nuclear bombs, first and foremost above them. That is the lie that really woke America up to the reality that, yes, our government lies to the American people about very important things, and, yes, the corporate media helps them do it. Okay? The readers and the advertising dollars are still out there, but they are coming to the alternative media. They're coming to Genesis Broadcasting. They're coming to WhatReallyHappened.com. Our readership numbers are going up. Our ad revenues are going up because the American people now know that the major TV networks and newspapers were part of the problem all along. And there's no way to get back from that. A lot of newspapers don't even do a paper edition anymore. They've gone to totally online content in the hopes that if they dress like a blog and act like a blog, that the readers will come back. And it's not going to happen because there's two kind of entities out on the Internet, blogs and flogs. Blogs are blogs. The flogs are the phony blogs, the corporate-owned websites trying to look like their blogs, trying to co-opt the name. But it's not going to work because people want to go where they're going to find the truth, and that is right here. Genesis Communication, this is the end of our show. We'll be back Monday night. Until then, stay safe, be well, drive carefully, hug your loved ones, have a good weekend, and aloha, America.